Today on Against the Grain. The early 20th century shares much in common with our time. It was an epoch of great extremes of wealth and poverty, of globalization and free trade, of war and imperialist occupation. But one crucial difference stands out. It was also a time of great militancy by the radical working class. And nowhere was this more apparent than in San Francisco on the eve of World War I, when a bomb exploded during a militarist parade on Market Street. Joseph Matthews discusses the class war in San Francisco a century ago. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. While U.S. officialdom has tried to obliterate it, the United States has a rich history of militant working-class culture in opposition to capital and the state, and much of it brought together overlapping struggles against wage labor and war, and for gender equity and liberation. Writer Joseph Matthews has sought to recover that culture in his novel, The Blast, which is set in radical San Francisco 100 years ago. He's the author of Shades of Resistance and Everyone Has Their Reasons, and is co-author of Afflicted Powers, Capital and Spectacle in a New Age of War. I should disclose that I have a connection with PM Press, which published The Blast. Joseph Matthews, can you describe for us the world in which the book is set in the years preceding the U.S. entry into World War I?
Yeah, Sasha, it's a time that isn't high in people's consciousness when they think about San Francisco, I don't think. We're talking about 1916 now. People think of San Francisco historically as, you know, Native Americans and the gold rush, and then suddenly they skip to the earthquake in 1906. And then there are these huge gaps, and then we're in the 1936 general strike, perhaps. And then all of a sudden we're in the 1960s and the Haight-Ashbury and the politics of Berkeley, et cetera. But in fact, you know, the formation of San Francisco, along with the formation of every urban space in America, had, you know, great roils of activity between the late 19th century and the mid-20th century. So San Francisco in 1916 is the product of a huge boom for capital in the West, in particular in San Francisco, in the 1880s and 90s, through the discovery of oil, through the opening of trade across the Pacific, through mining, through lumber. There was a huge boom, and it was centered for California in San Francisco in those days, not in Los Angeles. You then had the added boom of the Philippines War and Occupation, which is very little known, has a very tiny place in American consciousness, but what has been talked about as the Spanish-American War, in fact, led to a war of occupation in the Philippines, where the U.S. replaced the Spanish as a colonizer. And all of that massive military might and funding for the Philippines war and many years occupation was funneled through San Francisco. So again, you know, a huge boom for industry in San Francisco, which in turn created a boom for the big capital interests that ran those industries. Then, of course, there was the earthquake in 06 and the fire, but in the years immediately following, there was an enormous building boom because people meaning banks and investment folks, were willing to put tremendous amounts of money into San Francisco. Then you had the opening of the Panama Canal in 1912, which connected Atlantic and Pacific trading and once again boosted San Francisco's place in the world economy. In 1915, you had what was called the Pan-Pacific Exposition, a kind of world's fair to announce to the world that San Francisco, because of the Panama Canal, was back and was a huge boost for international trade, coming to and through San Francisco. So you had this enormous growth over these decades. At the same time, you had very, very strong labor organizations and labor consciousness in San Francisco. It was a heavy immigrant population, both European and South American. Anarchists and Wobblies, the IWW, had a heavy presence in San Francisco, and the trade unions were themselves, the traditional trade unions, were very strong, although they were also quite racist and misogynist. So you had, you know, a boom city with very strong capital interests, with lots and lots of money and power. You also had very strong labor. And what you had as a result in the early 1900s was almost continual labor capital conflict, class war, if you want, over a couple of decades.
Right. And this current of sort of class war from above and below is one that runs throughout the book. I wanted to ask you more about the labor conflict. You know, San Francisco is known for the militancy of workers on the waterfront, but long before the formation of the ILWU, the waterfront was a very violent place where pitch battles took place between labor and capital. Can you tell us about those struggles and the kinds of unions that were involved in the militancy of the time?
Yeah, the waterfront in San Francisco has always been, well, until recently, has always been a site of tremendous labor organizing, labor strength, but also confrontation with capital. The Seamen's Union was an enormously powerful union, as well as the Longshoremen's Union, and for a long time they worked hand in glove, not always, and were able to present a united front against capital, which on the waterfront meant the shipping industry. But the shipping industry was also, of course, connected to oil and mining and lumber, so there was an awful lot at stake on the waterfront. There were a number of waterfront shutdowns during the 1890s and early 1900s. There was one, in fact, during 1916, the period covered by the book, which ultimately wound up being a failure, although in other cities, interestingly, along the West Coast, the longshoremen held out a bit longer and got greater concessions. But the waterfront was a site of tremendous militancy, but it also has to be said that the Longshoremen's Union, as well as most of the other traditional unions in San Francisco, were also very exclusionary. That is to say, Italians weren't particularly encouraged to join, and there was a huge Italian immigrant population. Of course, there was a black population here that was completely excluded from the waterfront. The same thing is true of what was already a significant Chinese American population, as well as most Latin Americans. So you had, you know, and of course these kinds of exclusions carried on in the American labor movement all through the early part of the 20th century. So there was, you know, there was a lot of conflict, and within the space that was opened by the failure of the mainstream unions to include so many workers, the IWW, the Wobblies, and a number of anarchist organizations, although sometimes organizations is too big a word for them, filled that void and created pockets where excluded labor, that is labor excluded from the mainstream unions, were able to get together, organize themselves, and take actions, not always getting themselves work, but taking actions against the forces of the state and capital, including many free speech activities. There was a tremendous censorship from both the state and the church. The church being, at that time, the Catholic Church primarily, being a very powerful force that left labor was always struggling against, almost as much as they were against capital and the state. And then finally, of course, one of the big crucibles of 1916 in San Francisco was the question of American entry into the First World War.
Indeed, and while there was a great deal of opposition to U.S. entry into World War I from below, and I'd like you to tell us about that, there was also, and this is one of the themes the novel touches on, there was also divisions or fear of divisions of support for the U.S. entry into World War I among the elite class, including in San Francisco. Can you tell us about those differences from above and from below?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There were differences within within big capital, and there were differences, of course, between capital and labor on the question of U.S. entry. Maybe we should back up for a minute and remind folks that the First World War in its early years, 1914 and 15, was seen by many people in the United States, and of course by historians as well now, as really a fight for economic dominance in Europe, in continental Europe, and also between Britain and continental Europe. It wasn't a war of where, you know, sort of moral questions were on the line. It was a purely economic war. Many people saw it that way in the United States, particularly labor, who knew two things. One, that they were the ones, if the U.S. entered the war, they were the ones who would be going over and fighting and getting killed. And two, they knew that much of the impetus for the elites of capital to get the United States into the war was the enormous profits that industry would reap, as they do during every war. And so there was huge resistance among organized labor and working folks in particular, beyond organized labor, including anarchists and IWW members, against the war and against the push for the war, which took the form of a movement called the preparedness movement, which was really simply a euphemism for patriotism and flag waving and, you know, the kind of guilt that we've seen during the Vietnam War and during the wars ever since, that you know, if you aren't for American entry into the war, you're somehow not patriotic and you're not a true American. This was already going on in 1916, and you know, this, it broke down along labor and capital lines. However, there were segments of capital, of industrial might, of banks, of particularly on the West Coast, who simply didn't want to get involved in a European conflagration because they thought it might interrupt the flow of capital across the Pacific. And so the government in Washington was very concerned that they may not get full support by from California industry, which they needed for ships and for arms, if the U.S. entered the war. And so the one of the things the novel does is takes on this question through the use of a character who is sent by Washington to examine this matter of why it was that certain members of industrial elites in San Francisco might oppose the war, and examines to what extent that was a serious obstacle for the U.S. to enter the war, which they didn't for another year.
And the novel in question is The Blast. I'm speaking with its author, Joseph Matthews. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you've been describing a San Francisco in which the power of labor and the power of capital on the eve of U.S. entry into World War I was strong on both sides. And I wondered if you could describe in more detail the elite of the city and from where they drew their power and their profits.
Yeah, absolutely. San Francisco now, of course, is thought of as the center of tech, but has long been the center of finance for the West Coast. That is banking, insurance, and the related trades of shipping, trade across the Pacific, and then after the opening of the Panama Canal in 1912, Atlantic and Pacific trade. So the source of capital for San Francisco's elite was really multiform. There were people like the Spreckles who had sugar fortunes based on first in Hawaii and then in California. Oil was discovered and was being developed at a very rapid pace in California in the early 1900s. Mining and lumber, all of which created industry that was able to produce enormous amounts of armaments and other iron-based manufacturing. So capital was feeding mightily in California from the 1880s to the entry into World War I in 1917 on a number of these fronts. And of course, you then had the enormous breadbasket that is the Central Valley of California, the agricultural wealth. So it was money raining down from all sides, all of which was centered in San Francisco, which is where the capital had its centers of finance, its banks, and its investment companies.
Can you tell us about the power of United Railroads within the elite and the kinds of conflicts that were centered around it in that period?
Sure. The United Railroad is, which plays a major part in the novel, an attempted strike against United Railroad. United Railroad had the monopoly on streetcar and rail travel within San Francisco and in and out of San Francisco, connecting to the major transcontinental railroads. It was a virulently anti-union organization. It had powerful connections throughout city government and was connected to the other large trade organizations and larger formations of capital because, of course, if you control transportation within and around a city, you really are at the heart of its industrial communications. And so United Railroads had an enormous power in San Francisco, but its virulent anti-labor stance meant that it was a target by unions over the course of maybe 20 or 30 years of repeated attempts to organize its workers. It was the largest non-unionized employer in the city of San Francisco. So there were many attempts to organize it, which were met on several occasions with tremendous violence from strike breakers and hired detectives. In 1912, there was a strike that led to violence and deaths in 1916, which was covered in the book, in the novel. Another attempt to organize United Railroads led to violence. It was one of these employers that was a sort of institution in people's minds of anti-union, of the anti-union stance of San Francisco's capital. And so continuing to attempt to undermine it by organizing and creating a counter force by labor was a continuing struggle in over those decades. Interestingly, the United Railroads, the people who ran United Railroads, were tried and convicted of corruption in the early 1900s for basically buying the County Board of Supervisors votes to vote down putting their power source underground instead of having overhead electrical wires, which of course were ugly and dangerous, but they of course didn't want to spend the money, and so they bought off the city council. They were convicted, and it didn't really change United Railroads. The same people, in fact the same family, continued to run United Railroads. But what it did do was create a momentum among the public for the funding, which took place in a referendum, for the municipal railroad, what is still today San Francisco's public transportation system. People were so furious at what had happened that they spent the money, public money, to build a competing municipal railroad system, which eventually drove United Railroads out of business.
Can you describe some of the means that big capital and San Francisco entities like United Railroad would use to intimidate their workers, keep them from unionizing, and to try and divide people to break the kind of strong culture of working class solidarity that characterized San Francisco at that time?
Sure. There was, you know, a multi-front effort by United Railroad to keep United Railroad non-union, non-organized, but also to keep labor down in general. United Railroad was sort of the point industry for anti-labor action. First of all, United Railroad, that is, whenever there was organizing that took place, there was a tremendous amount of money spent on not just scab labor when a strike was called, but on provocateurs, on people who worked for United Railroad who claimed to be simple laborers, but who were in fact on the payroll of United Railroad, undercover people for United Railroad. There was a tremendous amount of anti-labor press in San Francisco that was funded by the forces of capital that were connected to United Railroad. So there was a broad front. There was also, of course, labor's own problem, which was that so many laborers were excluded from mainstream unions, that there were a lot of workers, many of whom were anarchists, many of whom were wobblies, many of whom were unaffiliated people of, people of color, people of, radical persuasion, who felt that mainstream unions simply didn't represent them, so that there was an existing split within the labor movement that the United Railroads did everything it could to promote by having agent provocateur within the union movements. And, they were extremely successful, even though San Francisco was a heavily unionized and labor-conscious city at the time.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Today, I'm joined by novelist Joseph Matthews. We're discussing his book, The Blast. He's the author of a number of books, including Shades of Resistance and Everyone Has Their Reasons. And I'm Sasha Lilly. So, Joseph, you were describing the tremendous efforts, formidable efforts, from those in the ruling class to divide this very militant working class in San Francisco, pit people against each other, derail their militancy and their organizing. And yet, what your novel, The Blast, describes is a world of enormous variety in San Francisco, of multiple radical milieus that intersected in the city and crossed over with Bohemia. I wonder if you could give us a sense of the flavor of that radical working class culture at the time.
San Francisco had a sort of a very early combination of bohemia and radical politics. Much of the novel takes place in the neighborhood of North Beach, which many of your listeners will be familiar with. It was the early Little Italy of San Francisco, but it also included people from many ethnicities who were excluded from traditional labor and traditional San Francisco culture. It was a fervent place, and it included a number of centers of anarchism, as well as the syndicalism of the Wobblies, the IWW. And it was because of the various factions that were centered in a relatively small space like North Beach, you had a very vibrant kind of ongoing dialogue between the various types and formations of anarchism, along with syndicalists and trade unionists, so that you had this kind of ferment going on in San Francisco. Much of it centered in this one neighborhood, which is the neighborhood in which much of the novel is centered. And the distinctions between and among anarchists, which of course people are vaguely aware of, but which I think doesn't get enough attention, doesn't get enough critical attention, because there's this sense that in contemporary times that when you say the word anarchist, you know, you think of a young black-clad person, usually male, with a bandana over his face, you know, breaking a glass window in a shop during a demonstration. That's as far as people's notion of anarchism goes. But in 1916 in San Francisco, there were a lot of very experienced, both organized and anti-organization anarchists, many of them with European roots, who were very heavily invested in attempting to radicalize, move labor from its rather conservative traditional union positions to the left. And you had parallel to and sometimes overlapping with these anarchists a very heavy IWW presence, although they were even stronger in the farther northwest. They had a very significant presence in San Francisco. In fact, the Wobblies set up a union local that was specifically described as a Latin union, because they wanted to include Italians, Spanish, Central Americans, and South Americans who have been excluded from traditional unions in an organization that could take action at various industrial sites. So you had, you know, a tremendous mix of people, and that included some of the very furthest extreme anarchists, people who were proponents of propaganda of the deed, meaning assassinations, bombings, other forms of targeted violence. And the book, the novel, The Blast, the title refers to a bombing that took place at a Preparedness Day parade, that is a big patriotic parade to try to push the U.S. into the First World War. The parade was bombed, and two labor militants were framed. Thomas Mooney and Warren Billings. Took them 20-some years to have their fraudulent convictions overturned. But in those 20 years, the position of organized labor in San Francisco took a huge nosedive because labor was blamed for this bombing. The fact is, it was probably a bombing that was carried out by some of the propaganda by deed anarchists, although there is certainly some question, and a question raised in the novel, about whether or not there were provocateurs from Capitol who participated in the bombing as a way to, number one, discredit labor, which was very effective, and number two, to end the question of whether the U.S. would get support for the war if it entered from San Francisco's industrial might.
We'll loop back to the bombing that took place in 1916 and its fallout in San Francisco. But I wanted to stay for a moment more with the question of this enormously varied and complex and interesting culture of the radical left, of the radical working class in San Francisco in the teens. And one of the things that's striking in the blast is how the militancy of various radicals, much of which is organized around syndicalist struggles over labor, also complements and intersects with a lot of organizing around gender, especially around contraception and the struggles of women. Can you tell us about that? Because it's part of a story that I think often gets lost or forgotten when we think about militant labor organizing of that period.
I think that's right, Sasha, that there's a notion that gender wars are a more recent phenomenon, when in fact, in 1916, San Francisco, particularly among the anarchist cadres, there was tremendous energy placed on the question of birth control, not quite so much abortion, but certainly around information about procreation and protection by women for women. And it was one of the subjects that anarchists in San Francisco and across the country, in fact, were very deeply engaged with. It's interesting, at the time of that the novel is set, 1916, Alexander Berkman, the famous anarchist, was operating, was publishing a journal out of San Francisco called, not coincidentally, The Blast. And that at the very moment of the novel, Emma Goldman, who of course spent much of her energy on gender questions, was staying with her former lover Berkman in San Francisco in their apartment on Dolores Street, publishing this newsletter. Anarchists in San Francisco for years had been engaged partly against the state and partly against the church, again, in struggles for information for women, which turned into, of course, free speech arguments and free speech actions. The police were enforcing the sort of codes of silence enforced by the church. And so there was a tremendous amount of interest among the anarchists, not just in labor questions, but in questions of the influence of the church on daily life, and in particular, the rights of women and the sources of information available to women. And there were many, many public actions by anarchists to support procreation and contraception information for women. There was also a very interesting and very little known sort of underground railroad of women physicians up and down the West Coast who were equally involved in providing medical care and medical information to women, as well as engaged in labor actions. These were radical women physicians, both in terms of their medical practice, their interest in, you know, the rights of women, and in left labor or actions in general. A very interesting group of women who knew each other, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, and who connected with each other around these questions.
Your novel, The Blast, reminds us of how not only was capital international, but labor was too. I mean, of course, it was a time of great migration, but a lot of the militants and radicals who found their way to San Francisco came from elsewhere and had been involved in struggles elsewhere, including one of the main characters of the novel, Blue, who is in Ireland and in England and helps the militant wing of the suffragettes. And again, since we tend to sort of forget the radical overlap between many of the movements of that period, I think it's often forgotten that there was a radical wing of the movement for suffrage. At the same time, the book also reminds us that there was also a kind of right wing, too, that ended up supporting World War I, especially the leader Emmeline Pankhurst. Tell us about that whole world and its left and right.
Yeah, I managed to bring into the book a section and then some echoes later in the novel about the English suffragettes, because at that moment, 1914, 15, 16, the suffragettes in England were gaining strength and prominence. And one of the questions that was being debated among the suffragettes in England at that time was the use of violence in support of their aims. But there were also splits among the suffragettes with regard to what kind of suffrage they were after. Emmeline Pankhurst, who was the sort of most famous of the English suffragettes, and her three daughters were all leaders of an early suffrage movement, which was looking for a kind of universal suffrage. At the time, working class men didn't have the vote either. There were property requirements for the vote in England, and so all women and working class men were excluded. And the original suffrage movement that came out of various socialist formations was interested in universal suffrage. But Emmeline Pankhurst, who was an upper middle class woman, wound up sort of getting control of the suffrage movement in Britain and pushing for suffrage for women on the same terms as men, which meant, of course, excluding working class, continuing to exclude working class men and women. A couple of her daughters, one in particular, Sylvia, joined with other more radical women and pushed continually for universal suffrage, and wound up not speaking to her mother for decades and creating a kind of oppositional suffrage movement, which was in conflict with the mainstream suffrage movement run by her mother, Emmeline. The conservatism of Emmeline Pankhurst was revealed further when Britain did enter the First World War, which it did almost immediately after Germany invaded France. And she became a militant, quote, patriot militarist who supported British entry into the war and turned on working class men, accusing anyone who opposed the war of, of anti-patriotism, of weakness. She became quite a horror for working class men who didn't want to serve in this slaughter on the continent, and further alienated herself from the left of the suffragettes in Britain, who unfortunately were shouted down, essentially, once, as often happens in times of war, once the patriotic flag started flying, it was very difficult to organize for anything other than support for the war. A lot of the notions that we have now about a kind of unified suffrage movement were complicated, and it should be said that there was a very strong suffrage movement, of course, in the United States, and that some unions, and particularly some anarchist groups, including the syndicalist Wobblies, were very involved in the suffrage movement for women in America, and some of the people who were connected to anarchist-led labor actions in San Francisco, Paterson, New Jersey, for example, sent people to England to attempt to help with the tactical movement within the suffrage movement, to try to radicalize that that wing of the suffrage movement in England, and that created bonds across the Atlantic between the left wing of the suffrage movement and anarchists and other left-wing labor organizers in San Francisco, New York, and really across the country.
I'm speaking with writer and novelist Joseph Matthews about his book, The Blast. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Joseph, you were mentioning a few minutes ago the network of radical women doctors that were involved in providing medical treatment and contraception to women in the period that your novel is set in the teens. But I wanted to ask you about doctors on the other side. In particular, a character in your novel is a doctor who is used effectively in counterinsurgency during the occupation of the Philippines by the United States, and in effect being used to torture captured fighters. You mentioned earlier the Filipino-American War, the violent occupation of the Philippines by the United States, and the way that that story sort of unfolds for you in the book. In particular, you note that technique that we now know as waterboarding originated actually during that period of counterinsurgency against the Philippines.
Yeah, that's right. The Philippine, the occupation of the Philippines, the U.S. military occupation of the Philippines, is a very much unknown story, or at least untold story, in U.S. consciousness. The U.S. In the Spanish-American War quickly ousted the Spanish from Cuba, and then the attention of the war was turned to the Philippines, which was at that time a Spanish colony. Once again, the Spanish were quickly ousted. However, the Philippines was a much bigger and more complex place than Cuba at that moment, and many many groups in the Philippines weren't ready to accept the U.S. as the new colonizer, and a guerrilla war broke out against the occupation, and it became a brutal war of occupation for a number of years. It makes its appearance in the novel in part because San Francisco and the military through San Francisco was intimately connected with the Philippines occupation. What happened was that without the kinds of communication, instant communication we have today, a lot of what happened in the Philippines War took place outside of the view and the consciousness of people in the U.S., let alone anywhere else in the war. Although interestingly, Mark Twain was, who of course was a journalist as well as a novelist, was covering that Philippines occupation and wrote some brilliant stuff about it. Unfortunately, he couldn't get all of his reporting published in mainstream newspapers in the U.S., and when it was sort of buried. But the occupation went on, and not just an occupation, but an active military campaign against various Philippine guerrilla organizations and guerrilla armies, and within the context of that occupation and that military battle, a number of the kinds of things that we have come to know as U.S. military, U.S. military and occupational tactics were begun in the Philippines occupation. Waterboarding is one that you mentioned. Another one is pacification, which of course is a term we heard in Vietnam, which meant rounding up huge numbers of people, clearing out their villages and putting them in essentially concentration camps to quote, pacify the areas where they've been cleared. These were the kinds of things that the U.S. military was doing in the Philippines, and there was very little consciousness of it at the time, and there's still very little consciousness of it in the U.S., although there has been good scholarship done about the Philippines occupation, and there was some good journalism done about it, but it's very much a footnote of what we call the Spanish-American War, which in fact was a Philippines war that went on for a number of years. It's one of those stories that needs to be told and retold, because the kinds of military adventurism that the U.S. Has continued throughout the 21st century really has its roots very far back, and is kind of unbroken line of these kinds of military interventions with various fig leaves of excuse. Interestingly, the Philippines occupation and war was one of the very first times when a condition that we now know as PTSD, post-traumatic stress, was observed clinically in soldiers, in American soldiers, being returned from the Philippines. And it was the first time that the military finally realized they had a serious problem on their hands among their own soldiers. Again, a story that isn't very well known, but which begins in the Philippines, although of course in previous wars, in the Civil War certainly, PTSD existed, but it came to consciousness during the Philippines War. Maybe another footnote, but a very telling one, I think.
The title of your novel, The Blast, takes its name both from the journal published by anarchist Alexander Berkman, but the bombing that took place in 1916 at a Preparedness Day parade, boosting support for the U.S. entry into World War I. And you mentioned that two labor organizers were accused by the state and tried for the bombing, Tom Moody and Warren Billings, and yet they were in fact framed up. I wonder if you can talk about the fallout that happened for Mooney and Billings, but for the radical left, the radical working class in San Francisco following the parade.
Yeah, we'll back up a little bit to the earlier question of United Railroads. This enormous industrial giant in San Francisco that was also the virulent point of anti-union activity in the city. At the moment of the Preparedness Day parade, these two labor activists, Tom Moody and Warren Billings, were engaged in an attempt to organize United Railroads. United Railroads had engaged a private detective agency as a kind of organizing focus for their anti-union activities, and they were focused on Moody and Billings. Whether or not those that detective agency, which was a very shadowy group, had anything to do with the bombing is a matter of some speculation, and the novel addresses that question. But in any event, as soon as the bomb went off, this private detective, Martin Swanson, was named by the district attorney of San Francisco, who had been appointed based on his support by United Railroads, appointed Swanson the leader of the prosecution or attempt to find those responsible for the bombing. They immediately discounted all of the obvious suspects, including a number of the propaganda of deed anarchists in North Beach, including the possibility of German provocateurs. There was also, of course, an ongoing struggle between the U.S. and Mexico at the time, and there was some question about whether or not There might have been participation by Mexican radicals in the bombing to oppose U.S. military intervention in Mexico. At any rate, Swanson ignored all of these and immediately pressed for and got the arrest of Tom Mooney and Warren Billings, who were, number one, representatives of labor in the eyes of the public, and two, were trying to organize United Railroads. They swiftly put together a case against these men. It was a fraudulent case from the beginning, and almost soon as the convictions were obtained, and Mooney was sentenced to death and Billings to life imprisonment, the case started to unravel because it was clear that the witnesses had been, some of them had been paid, some of them had perjured themselves, others were suppressed. A photograph showing Mooney a mile away from the bombing at the time it went off was suppressed. The case started to fall apart, but Swanson, United Railroads, and the district attorney who was in their pay put together this case, and importantly for them, representatives of labor were quickly convicted, and labor itself was tarred not only with the bombing, but their opposition to the war was also undercut by what was seen as labor's responsibility for bombing this Preparedness Day parade. It was an enormous blow to organized labor, and basically, once the U.S. Joined the First World War the following year, there were a number of federal laws passed which cracked down on anarchists. Many people were deported. Labor in general, there were a number of laws passed which forbade strikes in any military-related industries. And labor took an enormous hit and didn't really recover until the Depression, the early 1930s, and fully didn't reach its strength until the general strike of 1936, or a period of 20 years where labor really paid a price from this bombing.
Joseph Matthews is the author of The Blast, which we've been discussing today, and I should disclose that I have a connection to PM Press, which is the publisher of The Blast. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.